Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and it's time to get even closer to home with this Barbed Wire show. Joining us now from La Crosse, Kansas, is Brad Penka, the president of the Kansas Barbed Wire Museum. Hi, Brad.
Hello.
What's going on at the Barbed Wire Museum right now? Are people starting to show up for the annual Barbed Wire Festival?
Yep, it's actually just starting to get underway. Our festival events are actually held at the City Auditorium here in La Crosse, just because we have takes so much space to do that, but we also have events out here at the museum as well. But yep, they're all just now starting to pull into town.
How many people are coming this year?
I'm not sure. I've got several. Usually we have about 40 to 50 exhibitor tables set up in the auditorium and not sure how many we're going to have. We've had a few kind of calling in late. So
it's mainly, if I understand it right, an event where people buy, sell, and trade barbed wire samples and other barbed wire memorabilia, and it's just one of many conventions for barbed wire collectors?
That's correct. It's kind of the number of state conventions has dwindled a little bit in the past few years. It used to be several of them pretty much all over the western two-thirds of the U.S. There is one here in Kansas. There's also one in Colorado, Nebraska, New Mexico, Texas, and California.
Why do people collect barbed wire?
It's kind of like any other type of collectible. There's so many different varieties. Some of it is very unique. It's really attractively designed, and it's kind of like anything else. When there's multiple pieces of the same item, people just get attracted to it, and they want to see how many of the different designs that they can accumulate.
Tell me about what's in your museum. What kinds of stuff would people see if they visited the Kansas Barbed Wire Museum?
Well, our museum we talk quite a bit about Western history. Our main purpose is to educate people about the history of the barbed wire. When you first start to mention barbed wire to some people, they kind of look at you with a strange look and wonder how you can have a museum about such an odd type item. But then when you start going in and delving into the history, how much of an effect it had on the Midwest and really changed the face of this part of the country and had such an impact on the United States as a whole, they start to learn that it's got quite of an interesting background.
How do you get people through the front door, past that initial kind of surprise at the idea of a museum dedicated to barbed wire?
Well, that actually helps draw a few people in. We have advertisements out in tourist guides and just a lot of word of mouth. And people first, say they hear about that, it's sort of a curiosity, so they kind of have to come check out this curiosity and see what it's about, and then they're pleasantly surprised.
So you mentioned the history of barbed wire shaped the Midwest and the United States, but what is it about Kansas? What do you think Kansans need to appreciate about barbed wire in particular?
Well, Kansas is like some of the other states, but Kansas in particular was a very vast open range area, and there wasn't a whole lot out. It was just a big open area. And when people started settling, they needed some way to define their territory and kind of fence off what was theirs, and that's where the barbed wire kind of came into use. It started cutting up the territory, and what was a big open range was now full of kind of gridded out into defined areas.
When you look at barbed wire, do you feel a certain fondness for everything it's made possible, or do you feel kind of conflicted thinking about not just the way of life it created, but also, the wide open range that no longer exists because of it?
It helped to settle the range. There's been an old saying out there that they say the six gun settled the West, but actually,
when you say six gun, can I jump in and ask you what that means?
The gun, basically the Winchester gun, or the handguns, basically.
Okay, go on.
But that's just, that was kind of, you see a lot of old Westerns, and when you think about the old West, the first thing you think of is the old gunfighter and his gun in his holster and shooting and trying to settle the West. But a lot of that, unfortunately, some of that comes from Hollywood. I mean, that did exist. But so many say that the barbed wire is kind of what tamed everything down. It kind of took this big, open, wild territory and kind of settled it and made everything start to become more of a defined area.
I want to get Sarah Danton on this conversation. She's a professor of history at Weber State University, and she's got a book coming out called The Environment in the American West, A History. Hi, Sarah.
Good morning.
So we've heard a little bit about this history, but how did barbed wire change our thinking in this country?
To me, one of the things that was really critical about barbed wire was that it made physically manifest the whole township and range grid system, and it imposed a commodity idea of land on the West. It divorced land from its environmental possibilities and just made it property.
So talk to me about the Homestead Act. The Homestead Act seems like it's a significant piece of the puzzle. It's a partner with barbed wire in this.
Very much so. So if you think about the initial first wave of white settlers heading west, they did so in the 1830s and the 1840s. And they went to California, they went to Oregon, you had the Mormons going to Utah, and they absolutely skipped over the Great Plains because they took one look around and the one thing that they knew they needed for homes and fences and fuel and furniture was wood, and there's not any, so they kept going. But in 1862, you have the passage of the Homestead Act, and then you also, I think, critically have in 1869 the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad.
So how does the Homestead Act mitigate the problem of there not being trees?
So if you're going to give away free land, which is very attractive to people, then you also have to come up with the innovation for being able to live in this place that so many people had decided was not livable the first time around. And so the combination of railroad advertising talking about how wonderful this place was and innovation then like barbed wire makes people see that it's possible to create a 160-acre homestead out here in nothing but grass.
When I listen to the story of Barbed Wire by Roman Mars and his crew at 99% Invisible, I'm struck by what sounds to me like a narrative of economic freedom, like the freedom to prosper financially on your own plot of land, slowly but surely taking precedence over what seemed to have existed before, which was freedom of movement, freedom to roam. Do you think that's accurate?
I absolutely do. I think that all of this in some ways does get dictated by economics. And when it makes good economic sense to simply turn cattle out on the range, let them fatten up for a year without any effort and paying a cowboy next to nothing to round them up and buy them a one-way ticket to a slaughterhouse, then that works really well. But when that is no longer economically feasible, when you've got farmers and cattlemen clashing with one another, then people need to start demarcating their property and separating these economic functions so that everything still remains economically viable.
When we talk about land use like this, we're also talking about the environment, and your book coming out is The Environment in the American West. So I wonder how barbed wire changed our relationship with the environment.
I think it does two things. First of all, as I said, it creates a sense of land that becomes artificial and divorced from its environmental possibilities. When you fence off 160 acres and its township and range defined, you're not talking about, is there adequate water on there? What sort of topography is there? Is there rocky soil? Is there fertile soil? None of the land description anymore has any bearing to its environmental possibility. It's just a set of numbers on a piece of paper, on a deed that you buy. So to me, that was one of the critical things. It's part of making land a commodity rather than a resource for subsistence. And then I think the second thing is that barbed wire in particular is going to interfere with a lot of the evolution that has occurred for animals who've lived on the Great Plains, like bison, like pronghorns, for example. And they did not co-evolve with fences, and fences come in so fast that they are not really able to adapt, and they're going to pay the ultimate price for that.
So the other thing here is that the land wasn't, I mean, we've talked about the land being empty, but there were native people who traveled this land. Do you know how the first encounters between Native Americans and barbed wire went down? In Kansas in particular, if you happen to have that knowledge.
Well, it's shocking to them because, of course, they're used to being able to pursue game animals without having to encounter fences. And there's a wonderful story in the biography of Charles Goodnight where he is at his ranch and a very longtime associate, a Taos Indian named Lame Deer, comes to his ranch house and says, "I need your help." And Goodnight says, "Well, it depends on what it is." And he says, "I need you to tell me how to get home." And Goodnight looks at him and says, "What do you mean? Of course you know how to get home. You've been making this migration for years to come out and hunt on the plains and then go back home to Taos." And he says, and Lame Deer says, "Wire, wire everywhere. And there's so much barbed wire, he can't figure out how to get home anymore. All the ways that he had been able to travel across the land were now blocked off by these fences."
So, but it does seem like barbed wire was crucial in developing agriculture and a lot of the settlement that makes all of the cities that we have in this part of the country even possible at any point. Do you think that's right? I mean, could the West as we know it today exist without barbed wire?
What's interesting is that barbed wire gets used on especially these homesteaded farms. But as we all know, part of what's going to happen in Kansas and other places is that by the late 1880s, there's a pretty spectacular drought that's going to seize much of that country. And so many of those homesteads are going to fail. In Kansas, two-thirds of the homesteaded farms would ultimately fail. There's a wonderful image of this family that had homesteaded and they failed and they're going to have to go back east, and they've packed up their wagon, and on the side of the wagon they've painted the epitaph of their experience: "In God we trusted, in Kansas we busted." And so for a lot of those family efforts, they're going to bust out, and then you've got large-scale agriculture that's going to come in. And by that point, ranching has moved out of the way, and it makes it possible for really these huge agricultural efforts to succeed.
From the environmental standpoint, that does seem fascinating because so much of what rural Kansas is dealing with today is drought and water issues.
That's right. And we are in the American West as well. And there have been people who've called the Homestead Act a cruel joke because in some ways it didn't work well. It took 160 acres, which was the ideal size of a Virginia farm, and then tried to impose it in a more arid environment where it's too big to farm if you've got to irrigate, and it's too small to ranch. And this was the conundrum that a lot of ranchers and farmers encountered on the Great Plains.
It seems like barbed wire is part of an American settler's definition of progress. Is the definition of progress that barbed wire represents still with us today, do you think?
Progress is one of those loaded terms that I tend to get my students to wrestle with, because progress sometimes then, of course, comes at the expense of others. So, yes, there's settlement on the Great Plains and the progress that comes with enclosure that separates cattle and farmers. But in order for those pursuits to succeed, for that progress to be made, it comes at the expense of Native Americans who endure the Plains Indian Wars, relocation to reservations, and a real loss of subsistence and cultural vitality. So it's a double-edged sword, or barbed wire.
Brad Panka of the Kansas Barbed Wire Museum, is this all part of the story people get when they visit you out in La Crosse, Kansas?
Yes, actually, that's exactly right. I mean, the Homestead Act is one of the elements of the story that we try to tell and explain how it's connected with barbed wire.
Other than just, you mentioned before that the strangeness of what a barbed wire museum sounds like, but that draws some people to the museum. What else tends to bring people there in the first place? What's the curiosity?
Interest in Western history. This part of Kansas has a very broad history and it's very interesting. A lot of that has been brought about, again, as I mentioned, by Hollywood and the old Westerns with the cowboys. and cowboy and Indian battles and that type of thing. And that kind of it captures their interest. And then they come out here expecting one thing. And then when they get here and start to learn the true stories, they find out what how much different it really is from what Hollywood says, for one.
Is there something in your museum, an object or a display, that tells a side of this story that we haven't heard or makes this all hit home in a way that talking about history kind of abstractly doesn't quite get at?
Oh, we have several different things. One of the newest things that we're really kind of, I've been doing a lot of research on, is the impact of society impact of barbed wire, even in some of the bigger communities. And there was a lot of money made by these initial inventors and the three big men, Elwood, Glidden, and Hash. And they were very generous, and they put a lot of this money back into their communities through opera houses, a lot of schools, institutes of higher learning, the university in DeKalb. A lot of that is kind of been skipped over, that the barbed wire actually really impacted society, and actually I feel like in a lot of ways brought culture to people, surprisingly.
Brought culture to people? What do you mean by that?
By bringing, by having these, some of the things that, like, Jacob Hash had created, built an opera house and was able to use some of the money that he made from the barbed wire to educate people and bring things to them that they may not have otherwise had in their areas prior.
Brad, we've got a little bit of a bad line, so I'm going to have my producer look into that and see if we can get it fixed. We're going to hope to get right back to you. I'm going to turn back to Sarah Dant a little bit. Sarah, we were talking about the environmental implications and how the Homestead Act shaped the land in conjunction with barbed wire, but the other piece of it is the railroads. And we were just hearing about the financial piece of the barbed wire picture. What about the financial piece of the railroad picture? Because you mentioned that people were lured to Kansas by these three developments, one of which was, that the railroads were advertising to people, actively trying to change their mind about the environmental possibilities here for farmers.
There's a wonderful advertisement, which I happen to commit to memory because it's so great. One of these advertisements says, "This is the sole remaining section of paradise in the Western world. All the wild romances of the gorgeous Orient dwindle into nothing when compared to the everyday realities of Dakota." And so, if you live back east and you don't know what the everyday realities are of Dakota, you say to yourself, well, honey, let's pack it up and go west and make our fortune out there. Grab some free land and jump on the railroad to do that.
I guess what I wonder is, of course, it's easy to, in retrospect, laugh at some of these turns of phrase and laugh at the maybe cruel irony of some of the advertisements paired with things like "In God We Trusted," "In Kansas We Busted." But is there anything for us to learn from it today? Just thinking about, what to be skeptical of, what to believe in, and as far as this kind of stuff goes.
Well, I think that, the reality is advertising works. It's worked for a long time. It works today. It's why you decide that you absolutely have to have the latest iteration of whatever phone you have, because suddenly it's got a port in a different place and you can't live without it. You thought you could, but you couldn't. So to me, I find it very typical of the way you convince people to change their thinking. And barbed wire and railroad open up the West and make it possible for people to come west, to see the economic possibility of actually living here, because so much of the earlier history of the 19th century is this almost colonial-like relationship that the East has with the West. The West is the source of raw materials. You extract them from the West, and you take them back East where you actually make them into something. And barbed wire and railroads make it possible for people to come west and then stay here and live here.
Let's talk with Brad Penka again a little bit. Brad, right now, your museum is the only museum dedicated entirely to barbed wire, and La Crosse is considered the barbed wire capital of the world. You've actually patented that phrase there in La Crosse. But I hear that Texas has designs on edging us out of that market.
Well, there is actually another museum known as the Devil's Rope Museum in McLean, Texas. That we call it our sister museum. They have a large collection of barbed wire and related artifacts as well. Theirs also features a Route 66 museum. So ours still ends up, we keep ours restricted entirely to the barbed wire and fencing related topics. So that's where we still.
So you can sit, but it's a sister museum, so you aren't feeling threatened by that arrival on the scene?
Oh, no. Actually, just kind of an interesting story real quickly. A number of years ago when the museum was being built, a reporter had come out with a story that basically said that they were trying to take the title away from us. And we decided to take advantage of that situation. We staged a gunfight, so to speak, in Dodge City at a barbed wire show between the two institutions, drew media literally from all over the country, and capitalized on that. It really made a lot of benefit and got great advertising for both of us.
Well, do you think, though, that I guess I am curious, not just to create an antagonism, but I'm curious about whether Kansas has a special relationship with barbed wire or if it's the same as the entire Great Plains?
The one special relationship that we have here comes from the collecting side of it. This is actually the first barbed wire museum that was ever created, was built here in La Crosse in 1970, a little bitty building on Main Street, about 600 square feet, actually in the front of the chamber office. And this is where the collecting hobby really took off, back in 1967. So our claim to fame started from the more modern era.
Brad Panka, thanks so much for talking with us, and enjoy the Barbed Wire Festival this weekend.
Oh, I think we will. Sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun.
And Sarah Dant, I appreciate your taking the time to talk with us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Keep an eye out for Sarah's book, The Environment in the American West, A History. When Central Standard returns, we'll head to Salina, Kansas, to hear how that town is making its mark on the music industry. We'll be back in a sec.